Hello, I'm Neelke Oksal.
And I'm Chris Houghton. Coming up on As It Happens.
They've made their bed and they'll ally in it. North Korean soldiers already have boots on the ground in Russia's war against Ukraine. And today the two countries ratified a pact to come to each other's defense, which has observers concerned about the consequences.
And text and subtext. If you're getting crickets back after sending lots of LOLs and ROTFLs and TFWs, a new study suggests the short answer may be your tendency to use short answers, aka abbreviations.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Friday edition of AIH.
It is 6:01, and you're listening to As It Happens here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. We receive support from Bemidji Brewing, offering opportunities in the tap room all season long for holiday shopping and gathering. Find out more about pop-up shops, rentals, events, and more on Facebook. Bemidji Beer, nice catch. Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is The Beatles with It's All Too Much. To your
We'll be right back.
And that's It's All Too Much by The Beatles.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Failure to send. Canada Post workers are going on strike right before the busiest time of the year, which is stressful for people right across the country, including our guest, a small business owner who relies on the mail.
And rolling with the punches, the president of the University of Waterloo says the Ontario government needs to pony up more funding, because without it, there will be a lot fewer spots, even for the province's top students.
Action-packed, Russia and North Korea officially ratify a military treaty, solidifying an alliance that has ominous implications for their neighbors.
The Realist Deal. The late Tom Forrestal was one of Canada's most respected painters, and while his work was realist, a curator and friend tells us he wasn't afraid to bend the rules.
Hang in there. 3 years after it was snatched and replaced with a fake, a Yusuf Karsh portrait of Winston Churchill, known as the Roaring Lion, is back in its rightful place on the wall at Ottawa's Chateau Laurier.
And lol, hell breaks loose. TLDR, a new study suggests that those who text using abbreviations are perceived as less sincere. And NGL, TBH short forms could be the reason you're not getting a text back. Just FYI, ETW. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that still has its initial misgivings. They're sending a message by not sending yours. Today, Canada Post workers across the country went on strike after their union and the National Postal Service failed to reach a new collective agreement. Certain mail, such as pensions and unemployment insurance, will still be delivered, but regular mail has ground to a halt as the two sides tackle issues including wages, job conditions, and job security. The federal government has appointed a special mediator, but with the holiday season approaching, small businesses are getting very nervous. Melanie Sampson is the owner of High Love Greetings, which sends handmade gifts and cards. We reached her in Auburn, Nova Scotia.
Melanie, we've known for a while that a strike could be on the way. You woke up to the news. Were you ready for that reality?
I'm not sure I was ready. I thought that I was prepared. You know, you plan and you hope for the best, prepare for the worst. But when you actually wake up and go, oh my, I need to pivot in every possible way to try to keep my business going through the holidays. It's a bit of a shock.
Well, let's talk about that pivot. Most of your business is online. So what will this mean for your shipping costs right out of the gate?
Sadly, I think that it means that a lot of things just won't get shipped at all. Things that do get shipped will certainly cost more. It really will come down to if there is another shipping alternative that I can use for a particular person's address, or if they're willing to pay that much more. For example, if I'm selling a greeting card for $10, I can't imagine somebody will willingly pay $20 or $25 or more to have it shipped.
That's a huge jump. What would it be normally if the strike wasn't happening?
I typically use letter mail, particularly within Canada. Mm-hmm. So even an oversized letter mail, it's usually about $1.94 plus tax within Canada. So, you know, I'm on the East Coast, I ship all over Canada, and letter mail is the far and away popular choice because it lets me not pass along a lot of extra cost to my customers.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. You know, I wonder this morning if your inbox has been filling up with messages from customers or cancellations. What are people saying so far?
I haven't had any yet. Mm-hmm. I'm actually still drafting a message that I'll be sending out and reaching out to anybody whose order I think is affected, because with letter mail, of course, there's no tracking. And I have no idea where some of these packages that I've shipped out over the last 5 to 10 business days, which is a typical letter mail transit time, where it might be. Otherwise, for the orders that I have outstanding, I'll be reaching out to folks one by one. Some may just need to cancel, and I'll be handing out refunds, which is really tough this time of year.
even without this Canada Post strike, how have you seen expectations around shipping times change?
It's definitely shifted. There seems to be, even more so in the last few years, an expectation that just because you sell something online, no matter if you are a solo entrepreneur or a small to medium business, that you can maintain the standard that these mega internet corporations have set. And they are just, quite frankly, unrealistic. And it is not within my power to put together orders and ship them out and have them across the country or across the continent in 2 days. It's just never going to happen. So when I receive an email from a customer, say from Etsy, who's upset that their order to California has not arrived in 48 hours from me on the East Coast of Canada, it becomes tough to explain that, you know, I'm not Amazon, I'm not a mega corporation, that I have no control once it's in transit of how long it takes truly to get there. It becomes a tougher conversation, especially with cross-border shipping, because it is just this unrealistic expectation that folks have. And it's really hard because that can often be the deciding factor between, do you shop from this little handmade shop or do you shop from the mega corporation who's promising you something only they can deliver?
Timing is crucial here. It can be a form of leverage, certainly for striking workers and their union. What will this timing mean for you?
I honestly don't know. And I think that's what worries me. But I also know that as a small business owner, you have to be able to adapt and pivot really quickly. I'm looking at hand delivering a few orders in my region. The timing, honestly, I get it. You know, I hope that they strike a fair deal. I really do. But it just means that I'm not going to be earning over the holidays.
And how much of your earnings are made in this window?
A vast majority. Christmas is by far the biggest gifting holiday for me, and doing in-person markets is really tough. Anyone who's done it knows that. So this year I had actually cut back on the number of markets that I was planning on doing. So I only have a couple of real small local ones remaining between now and Christmas. So there's no way that I will, you know, sort of go through my planned supply just by attending those couple of markets. And it'll be an interesting challenge. You know, I'm grateful and I'm privileged that, you know, my husband works, I work at this. We'll make it by. You know, that's okay. And I'm very grateful and lucky to be in that position. But it will certainly impact what investment I'm able to make in my business in the new year. How I plan for next year as a whole will depend on how I do over the holidays.
You have your hands full, I can hear. We won't keep you too much.
It's my little kitty cat named Holly, and she's very upset that I'm not playing with her right now.
Okay, Holly, we'll let you get back to Holly in just a moment. But on the issue of, you know, a deal being made, hopefully soon, for all involved. The federal labor minister, Stephen McKinnon, said to reporters this morning, quote, "I'm not looking at any other solution other than negotiation right now," unquote. What would you like to see the labor minister do? Would you like to see an intervention as there has been in other job action across the country?
I'd like to see the employees get a fair deal. That's what I'd like to see. And I'd like to see it happen so that we have a system that works and that's sustainable, because it's a service that we all need and I think our country needs. So I'd like to see some support from the government in terms of if they need more mediation or something. But I would like to just see it resolved as soon as we can with a good, fair deal.
Melanie, I appreciate your time. Good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
Melanie Sampson is the owner of High Love Greetings, which sends handmade gifts and cards. We reached her and Holly the Cat in Auburn, Nova Scotia. His paintings captured Atlantic life and landscapes with an impressive amount of detail. But the late Tom Forrestal, who has died at the age of 88, was anything but conventional. He was one of Canada's most esteemed realist painters, and his passion for the work is clearly evidenced by the sketchbooks he filled growing up in Nova Scotia's Annapolis Valley. Later, hundreds of those sketchbooks went on display at the Beaverbrook Art Gallery in Fredericton, where he briefly worked in the late 50s. Here's Mr. Forrestal talking about the purpose of those sketches.
They're pretty rough. There's no pretty little pictures in here. They're nothing refined or finished. They're, as I say, sort of grubby little, sweaty little workhorses that lead me places. The vision in your mind's eye has an unearthly perfection. There's something almost divine about that vision in your mind's eye because you can hold it in your mind's eye because you never hold it in your hand.
The late Tom Forrestal talking to the CBC. Ray Cronin is an artist and the curator of Canadian art at the Beaverbrook Art Gallery. We reached him in Fredericton.
Ray, it's so beautiful for me to hear that. As someone who knew Tom Forrestal and his work, does what you heard there match up with the person you knew?
Oh, absolutely. Tom was very philosophical. He thought about his work and what making work meant. Anyone who's ever seen the back of a Tom Forrestal painting, they're usually covered in text with ideas about what that painting or drawing was about. So, you know, one of his favorite sayings was everyone looks, but few see. He was very interested in that slowing down and him talking about workhorse drawings for him to inspire him. I'm hearing that. I can see him leafing through his sketchbooks.
Yeah.
It's very interesting to hear.
Elsewhere in that interview, he talks about that process of making something great, that you could flip through those pictures and those sketches in the book and they're not all great. And I think to artists, that would be kind of freeing to hear as well.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, you know, Tom never felt that he really got to great. You know, he always felt that no matter how pleased he was with something, it could always be better. And that's what drove him to make the next piece. He always felt that he had this vision that he was trying to get out, and the vision was so perfect, and making it in material, you know, it was always harder. But he never stopped. He never stopped trying to make it perfect, to make it live up to what he was, you know, what he had in his mind's eye.
Yeah. What do you see, Ray, when you look at his work at the gallery? What do you perceive?
I see a painter who, Tom was a contradiction. He was a committed realist. And for somebody who came of age as an artist in the 1950s, choosing to make realist paintings was you know, it was kind of political, right? I mean, realist painting in the 50s was seen as being very conservative, and you know, artists who were on the cutting edge were doing abstraction, and by the time you got into the 60s, it was pop art and minimalism and performance art, and Tom just sailed through all that. He was intent on what he wanted to do, but he also was a very revolutionary painter in that he wouldn't accept, one of his favorite sayings was that we have to break the tyranny of the rectangle. he just thought, why should every painting look like a window, right? Like, why should they all be the same shape? And he just advocated constantly that paintings could be whatever shape the artist wanted, and it could add more power to a work. So, you know, there's a painting hanging in the art gallery right now that's shaped like an hourglass with clouds at the top and then this narrow little spout going down, and then it opens up again to cows in a field, and then it narrows again and then it opens up at the bottom into a pool of water. And you get so much, you know, it actually is a much more dynamic and, I think, you know, kind of cutting edge feeling painting. He really did try to push boundaries of what he was doing, and he got put in the Atlantic realism box, and which, you know, he was proud of the artists that he was associated with, but he did try and was doing things that were outside of the norms for painting. I thought he was someone who was really always trying to be innovative, and that's you know, when someone's well into their 80s and still to change the way people think about painting, that's really impressive.
He was on our show in 2015. after painting, when you talk about breaking rules, he painted his own 34-year-old Mercedes to represent the Four Seasons. I know, I think he wasn't entirely happy with how it turned out, but do you remember that project?
I do. It was fantastic. Yeah. It was fun. And you know, but it was also typical Tom, right? Because he got a new Mercedes out of it. right? And buying that Mercedes was such a huge step for him.
Yeah.
But then he kept it for 34
years. It was a sponsored project.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so it was something where he that was his car, but he had owned for 34 years. He bought the car when he sold a painting. His wife, Natalie, encouraged him, but he was not the guy that would get a new Mercedes every year. He kept that one on the road, running beautifully and maintained beautifully for 34 years, and then got it sponsored to do the painting with Mercedes.
I'm glad you mentioned Natalie, because in earlier coverage that CBC News did with him, he talked quite beautifully about the fact that she was his muse, and that because she took care of everything else and encouraged him to keep painting, he did keep painting.
Yeah.
She kept him doing the work, but what drew him to it initially?
I think part of it may well have gone back to, so Tom had epilepsy, and you know, in the 1930s and 40s, there was much less medical help for him, and it sort of cast him outside of the community. He was not able to participate as fully in sports and other kinds of pursuits that people were, you know, he wouldn't go hunting with his cousins. But with art was something that he could excel at without it being affected by his medical condition.
You met with him just last week. What did you talk about?
So he and his son Frank had set up an art gallery in a huge house in Dartmouth, and they had his granddaughter's Marie's work in it, and there's Tom's work, and some of, you know, Frank has work there. And so we were just walking around looking at these objects, and he was talking to me about he wanted to write a book about shapes and about the, you know, the shape of paintings, and about
the tyranny of the rectangle,
you know, how to break the tyranny. Yeah, he was I asked him what he was working on, and he was doing a series of watercolor paintings of shells. So at least up until last week, he was working away, which I love knowing.
Me too, Ray. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure.
Ray Cronin is an artist and the curator of Canadian art at the Beaverbrook Art Gallery. He's in Fredericton. Lion is back home. That is the title of a photo of Winston Churchill, taken by the late Canadian photographer Yusuf Karsh during the darkest days of the Second World War. And Mr. Karsh gave a print to the Chateau Laurier, the Ottawa hotel where he worked and lived. But nearly 3 years ago, it was stolen. Today, though, the chateau held a ceremony to mark its return. There were speeches from hoteliers and politicians, and the Ottawa detective responsible for tracking the portrait down to an unsuspecting buyer in Italy. That buyer was a collector named Nicola Cassinelli, who gave the Roaring Lion up when he realized it was stolen. And he sent a letter to be read at today's ceremony.
Dear friends, for almost 2 years, I've had the extraordinary privilege of living with a remarkable masterpiece of art and history. I had hanging in my living room, without even knowing it, an artwork whose significance goes beyond its mere beauty. The magnificent photograph by Yusuf Karsh captures, in the eyes of Sir Winston Churchill, the pride, the anger, and the strength of the free world. And it represents, better than any other, the desire for the triumph of good over evil. This is a work that cannot belong to one person and cannot be confined to the private space of a living room. The Roaring Lion belongs to anyone who cherishes freedom. For this reason, and out of my deep respect for the Crown, the government, and the people of Canada, I did not hesitate to return it, waiving my rights as a good faith purchaser and the financial benefits I could have derived from it. I am pleased that today the Roaring Lion is once again on display for the public, who could enjoy one of the most significant photographs in our history. Thank you.
That was Lori Wagner, the Chateau Laurier's Director of Marketing, reading a letter from Nicola Cassinelli. In September, when news broke that the case of the Roaring Lion had been cracked, Neil asked Mr. Cassinelli what it had been like having the famous photo all to himself.
It's like having the Mona Lisa in your living room. Something doesn't happen every day, of course.
When did you first realize that something might be wrong?
In October 2022, I received a phone call from the auction house. They told me at that time there was an ongoing investigation about a theft of a copy of the same portrait. In, I think, November 2023, I was called back by the auction house, who asked my permission to give the Canadian police my contacts. And then in January this year, I had the opportunity to speak a couple of times with the Ottawa police, who explained me that according to his evidence, my portrait was the stolen one. Mm-hmm. And so I decided to go to the Carabinieri. And after a few weeks, they called me to confirm me that it was the stolen one. So at that time, I decided to return it because of the historical value it has.
Did you have a choice to give it back or not?
Yeah, I have a choice because I am a good faith buyer. So I bought in good faith, and I was not obliged to give it back. They would have needed to start a lawsuit against me to obtain it, but I didn't want it to happen. I just wanted to.
You wanted to do the right thing.
To return it, yes, because I don't buy art to exploit it. I like art, but an artwork cannot be considered just a private property.
Was it hard to let it go?
Yes, it was hard, but I thought that being part of this story is much more valuable than keeping that portrait for me. It's something incredible. I can confess that the day I gave the portrait to the Carabinieri, I also bought online a copy of this of this portrait for a few dollars, so that I still have a replica of that.
That was Nicola Cassinelli talking to Neil in September. Today, the Roaring Lion was officially returned to its place of honor in the Chateau Laurier in Ottawa. LMK, if you are a short texter, that U is the letter U, BT dubs. Lol, NVM. I know, I sound very cool, but you have to admit those abbreviations don't work quite as well in a verbal context. And according to a new study, we really shouldn't be using those abbreviations at all, at least not if we want to be taken seriously. Researchers at Stanford University and the University of Toronto have found that people who use abbreviations when texting are perceived as less sincere and are less likely to get a response. David Fang is the lead author on the paper, and we reached him in Stanford, California.
David, it kind of makes me cringe just to see this, let alone say it out loud, but our producer Cassie is making me. HRU, David.
Hey, Neil, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Love a full sentence. Thank you, David. You were inspired to do this in large part because of your brother. What was there one text in particular or a series of texts from your brother that triggered this for you?
I can't recall kind of a very specific text, but I do recall an experience where I sent him, I think, two paragraphs worth of text. And I think we were going on family vacation and we're just planning the trip. And then he just sends back kind of a single K and a thumbs up. And I was just kind of blown away by how little effort he put in.
Like, I poured my heart out, all the details. K? Yeah, I hear you. Maybe a happy medium between the two of you might be the best result. But let's get into the details of your research. You looked at texts from more than 5,000 people. What specifically were you trying to find there? What were you looking for?
Yeah, so So we were looking at texting abbreviations, so essentially shortened versions of text. Like, for example, using the letter U instead of the word U when you're kind of texting. And we wanted to know whether kind of using these shortened versions of texting words could influence how other people kind of perceive how sincere you are when you're texting.
And how did that use of abbreviation change the way the messages were received? We know how you received them and how I might receive them, but in general, how were they received?
Yeah, through 18 experiments, through 10 experiments, we found that kind of when people see messages with abbreviated texts, generally they perceive the other person as being less sincere, and consequently they're less likely to reply back to the text and want to continue a conversation.
I wonder if those folks want you to reply, though, when they just reply with a thumbs up and a K.
Yeah. So I think in general, people kind of want to maintain positive relationships, at least through text. So it's kind of surprising that it happens quite often.
What did you find across different age groups? Because I think there's an assumption that there's a divide here.
Yeah. So generally, young people tend to use more abbreviations when they text. But we actually found that young people, they don't like abbreviations just as much as older people. So kind of they perceive the other party as being just as insincere when they kind of view abbreviations. Quite surprising.
That's good. That challenges some of those stereotypes. I know our producer rolled her eyes at some of them. She said, who's writing these things? Nobody writes like this. I don't know how she feels about paragraph text, though. We'll research that later. How does your brother feel about being a catalyst for all of this?
Yeah, so he feels quite intrigued. And so ever since then, he's actually tried to make an effort to improve kind of his texting habits.
Oh. But
he
heard you. How is he younger than you?
So he's 6 years older than me.
See, challenging that misconception again. What argument would you make to people to try to convince them, if they are writing HRU and LMK, BT dubs, all of that, what would you say to them to try to convince them to give the whole word, maybe the whole sentence, a try?
Yeah, for sure. So I'll say that if their goal is to try to build better relationships that are longer lasting, perhaps kind of invest a bit more time and be more thoughtful as to how they compose their texts. So kind of when they're kind of looking at their texts, maybe spend some time kind of thinking about how the other party might feel when they send out that particular text and what kind of text they would prefer receiving.
Do you think people should eliminate abbreviations altogether?
So I think that the conclusion shouldn't be that people should stop using abbreviations altogether. So I think that kind of that abbreviations exist for a reason. So it's really common. We generally find that over 90% of people tend to use abbreviations routinely. So I'm sure that it exists for a reason, maybe particularly to save time. So maybe in some relationships where we're not super interested in kind of having a long-term kind of sustainable, long-term relationship, perhaps, like, for example, if you're texting like a delivery driver through Uber Eats, perhaps it's more optimal during those periods of time to use more abbreviations.
Definitely don't write them a paragraph. Yeah.
Yeah.
David, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
David Fang is a doctoral student at Stanford University, and we reached him in Stanford, California.
We're going to take a quick break now. When we return, the president of Waterloo University tells us the provincial government needs to act quickly, or 100,000 spots for new students could disappear at schools across the province.
And comrades in arms, Russia and North Korea make their defense pact official, which is not the kind of international cooperation the rest of the world is overjoyed to see.
Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you.
6:35, and you're listening to As It Happens, a CBC program here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up at 7 o'clock, it's going to be On the River with your volunteer host, DJ the DJ. That'll be from 7 to 10 p.m. We receive support from the Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. We receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Learn about canvas teepee construction with artist Rory Wakeemup at Rail River Folk School in Bemidji, November 18th through the 23rd, from noon to 4 each day. It's an open workshop for anyone who wants to learn or observe the process. Now we'll take you back to As It Happens.
Ontario universities are once again making it clear that they are in trouble. A new report from the Council of Ontario Universities warns that without more funding, 100,000 spots for new students could be cut across the province over the next few years. The authors write that a litany of financial strains have stretched post-secondary institutions thin, among them higher salaries, tuition freezes, and a federal cap on international study permits. University of Waterloo President Vivek Goel says his university is facing a $75 million shortfall this year. We reached him in Waterloo.
Vivek Goel, doing the work that you do and looking out at the landscape on your campus, financially anyway, what worries you most about the situation you're in right now?
So the thing that's most worrisome is that we're losing sight of the future. And that's, I think, what this message is really about. If the current government policies continue, we will have to cut back on programs and services for our students and the number of spaces that are available. Furthermore, those students, those graduates, are the future of our country, our society, our economy. And by cutting off the access for those individuals, our most talented students are going to look for opportunities elsewhere, and we're going to lose that talent from Ontario.
And then they'll stay wherever they study often and get jobs there, is what you're saying.
Absolutely, yeah.
When you talk about potential reductions, what does that look like on a university campus or in a university classroom?
Well, so the first thing is, trying to maintain the services for the students with our diminishing resources. And so that will mean that we won't have, it could be something as mundane as classrooms and facilities might be cleaned less often, and that's going to affect people's experience, to larger class sizes, longer wait times for different types of services like writing labs. There's a whole range of things that will start to deteriorate that will have an impact.
The report from the Council of Ontario Universities says, right at the outset, quote, "We acknowledge the government's initial investment of nearly $1.3 billion over 4 years across 23 universities and 24 colleges as a crucial first step towards stabilizing the sector." Our listeners tuning in will say that certainly sounds like a lot of money, but you and the other schools are saying it's nowhere near what you need. Why is it not enough?
Yeah, so, it is certainly a very substantial amount of money, and we're very grateful for that support. As the quote notes, that does cover a lot of institutions. That total of $1.4 billion included a number of different funds. The amount that was actually around the financial sustainability was closer to $800 million. And when you split it out amongst all the institutions, the shares that individual institutions got was a fraction of the deficit that they were facing. Furthermore, that money is for 3 years, and there's no guarantee about what happens beyond that. And so, again, from an institutional perspective, it's very difficult to plan for the long term, to hire the faculty. There's a lead time to recruiting the talented faculty that we need. And without the certainty of what that funding is going to be in the future, we won't be able to meet the demand when it comes to us.
And we should also say that the expert panel that the government commissioned last year to put together this report and make its recommendations had recommended $2.3 billion in spending increases.
Yeah, they'd recommended many times more. And they also recommended that the tuition freeze be unfrozen so that the total revenue that the institutions got would be even greater. And so if they're the quote from the Blue Ribbon panel, the amount that they recommended was predicated on the tuition also being unfrozen.
We requested a statement and received a response from Ontario's Ministry of Colleges and Universities. It reads in part, quote, funding for post-secondary institutions is higher than it's ever been, unquote. And when the provincial report came out last year, the then Universities Minister Jill Dunlop said she would not agree to any significant fee hikes until schools looked at all possible efficiencies. So what do you say to those who ask, is Waterloo operating as efficiently as possible?
So first of all, in any organization, there's always room for efficiencies, and we're always looking for those. But we have had decades of this trend, and so we have been doing many things to make ourselves more efficient and effective. You know, the other part of that response, the initial response that you got today, the funding, certainly that was a significant increase. But the Blue Ribbon panel also showed that Ontario universities have the lowest funding in the country for the amount of students that we teach. And so in that sense, you could look at those numbers and see we are already operating incredibly efficiently relative to other institutions. But that doesn't mean we won't look for more efficiencies as we always do.
15% of all students are international students at Waterloo University, as I understand it. So how much of this is an issue of provincial underfunding or Canada's federal government cutting off a significant revenue stream for you, given what's happened on that front? Is that a bigger problem?
No. So the $75 million shortfall that we had in the current year and that we forecast for the next year, the loss in international tuition revenue represents a very small fraction of that. It is obviously an important impact that will compound in future years if the trends don't turn around. But right now, our budget pressures are primarily driven by the caps on the government grants and the tuition freeze. And then the reason international students grew was because of the limitations on provincial funding. So, you know, I'm not going to get into this government or that level of government. I think all levels of government need to look at that in a coordinated way.
Vivek Goel, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Vivek Goel is the president of the University of Waterloo. We reached him in Waterloo. When he died in 2016, Suleiman Fakhiri was 30 years old, and last year a coroner's inquest confirmed what his family had believed all along, that he had been killed by correctional officers during his time in an Ontario jail. Mr. Fakhiri was a top student at the University of Waterloo when he was in a car crash at the age of 19. He was later diagnosed with schizophrenia. His brother Yusuf says he subsequently changed into a different person. A new documentary called My Brother Suleiman focuses on the time he spent waiting for a medical assessment in jail, which wound up being his last days alive. Yusuf Fakhiri has been campaigning for accountability since his brother was killed and has told his story on this program in the past. Today, he told David Common, host of Metro Morning, about the systemic change that he wants to see now.
When someone loses their life at the custody of the state when they're vulnerable. And these inquests, although they're not binding, what these inquests do, just because they're not binding, government has an opportunity to implement it. They can't just ignore it. And when they keep ignoring coroner's inquest recommendations, when more and more deaths happen, it says to us that the system needs to change. So just because it's not binding does not necessarily mean the government shouldn't implement it. And what this also says to me is that people suffering from mental health challenges, their lives are viewed as cheap. It's not viewed the same way as others. And this is very tragic.
This documentary has been made. It's called My Brother, Suleiman. In the documentary, there is this interview with a correctional officer who was there at the time. His name is Clark Moss. What was it like hearing him recount his experience?
You know, it was powerful. I wish there's more people like Mr. Moss within corrections. It just shows a difference in how Mr. Moss treated Sully and the guards that treated him on the last day of his life. But it says to us, gives us some glimpse of hope when you have individuals that show compassion.
What did he say about that?
Sully changed his life. That interaction with Sully changed his life. Sully might have been gone, but that interaction allowed Mr. Moss to reflect within himself and to see what he's doing. And to hear that, it says to me that Sully mattered. And it says to me that my brother's voice and his life had some value. And to hear that, it gives me hope that there's many Mr. Mosses within the correctional system.
You say that about one individual. You have hope that there are more. But has the message that you have received since that coroner's inquest said to you, your brother's life mattered?
Canadians across the nation have reached out to me. They give me hope. Individuals that have suffered from mental health challenges have given me hope. Just because government hasn't acted on the inquest recommendation does not mean that I should stop. It gives me more resilience and persistence to continue. And that one day, just one day, the system will change. It might not happen in my lifetime, but Solomon mattered. He was a brother. He was a son. And I'm not going to stop until I make sure that his tragedy has an impact into the systemic policy change within corrections.
That was Yusuf Fakiri speaking to David Common, host of Metro Morning in Toronto, about the new documentary, My Brother, Suleiman. It's available on CBC Gem and the CBC Docs YouTube channel. They already had a relationship, but now it's official. North Korea and Russia have pledged military support to one another, promising to come to each other's aid if either is attacked. Both countries ratified the pact this week. And earlier this week, a U.S. State Department official said 10,000 North Korean troops have already massed in the Kursk region of Russia. Kang Vu is a North Korea analyst and writer and a visiting scholar at Boston University. We reached him in Boston.
Kang, what do you think is motivating this pact right now? What is in it for Russia and in it for Korea to make this alliance official?
I would say that this is probably a marriage of convenience. So the war in Ukraine in 2022 and Russia not kind of going well with it kind of opened the door for the North Korean to say to the Russian that, hey, we can provide artillery, we can provide arms, and maybe we can provide men if you Russians need to. And the military pact is just a way for both countries to formalize that level of military exchanges.
What do you think the rest of the world should be most mindful of right now when we look at the developments between Russia and North Korea?
So I would have to say that there are two things that we need to be mindful of. The first one is whether the North Korean troops, they would wear the North Korean military uniforms in the future. So far that they have only worn the Russian military uniform. So that suggests that there may be some degree of restraint on the North Korean. They don't want to provoke anyone. They just want to send the soldiers there, earn money, and go back. But if the North Korean soldiers, they wear North Korean military uniforms, then that sent a big signal to everyone that they're invested and they are willing to stand side by side with the Russians. The second thing that we need to look at is whether North Korea would allow its troops to go deep into the Ukrainian territory, which is the eastern part of Ukraine under Russian occupation right now. So per the alliance treaty, the North Korean only defend Russian soil. So that means that it's unclear whether the North Korean, they recognize the breakaway region of Ukraine as Russian soil. So if the North Korean, they send troops deep into Ukrainian territory to defend the Russian gains. And that is also a major escalation.
And in terms of the troops from North Korea who are already in Russia, what do we know about what they've been doing so far?
What we are aware of at this moment is that the North Korean, they have been sending probably around 10 to 12,000 troops to the Russian region of Kursk. And the North Korean troops, when they arrive in Russia, they receive Russian military uniform. They are equipped with Russian arms, and they are sent to the Kursk region to probably join the Russian counteroffensive against the Ukrainian occupation there. The Russian government, they probably paid the North Korean government around $2,000 per soldier every month. So that is not a small sum of money for a country like North Korea. So at this moment, we have received reports that the North Korean troops have engaged in combat with the Ukrainian troops on the front line in Kursk, so which is technically still on Russian soil. We have not seen any reports that the North Korean has actually joined the Russian advance on Ukrainian soil. So the North Koreans so far have only participated into a counteroffensive on Russian soil.
And we should underline the fact that this is the first time North Korean troops have been stationed outside the country since the Vietnam War. I wonder, as much as you know about these countries, you know, what might it be like for these North Korean soldiers, keeping in mind they likely have very little reliable or fulsome information about the conflict that they are now involved in?
So I would have to say that obviously for a country like North Korea, the common soldier is not allowed to understand or to interact with the wider world. But in this situation, before the North Korean government, they sent troops, they already sent a lot of laborers to Russia. These people, they help rebuild or reconstruct the region that are under Russian occupation. So these soldiers, they are simply are in the same pipeline, is that they get sent to Russia, and in exchange, they get a salary for their military service, and which the North Korean government will take a cut of that, and that will benefit the regime. I am not particularly sure how the North Korean soldiers, they understand or how they will interact with the wider world, because that is something even the Ukrainian government is not particularly aware of. They have been launching some psychological offense against these North Korean troops by publishing leaflets saying that if you defect to the Ukrainian side, then you can have good food, then you can have freedom and this and that. But so far, we have only seen a report of 18 North Korean defections from the military, which is not a big number if we consider the 10,000 of soldiers being deployed into Russia. So I will say that there is a limitation to how much the psychological warfare can work, because we don't know what the North Korean soldiers know about the world. Yeah. Are they curious? We don't know.
Do you know whether those defectors, a small number as it may be, as you said, you know, are these troops in Ukraine?
There are reports that the North Korean commanders and the Russian commanders have already get those soldiers back.
So they defected and then they were retaken?
Yep.
By Russia and North Korea. What would the consequences be?
I have to say that may be concentration camp or obviously punishment of your family if they left behind families when they travel overseas. But this is all speculation. So I have to be careful when we have no sources confirming whether what kind of punishment they will receive when they return to North Korea or when they are recaptured.
What do you think Donald Trump's re-election might mean for U.S. relations with North Korea? Obviously, Donald Trump, as you know, is known for talking loudly about his relationships with Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin.
So one of the key points that people often miss when talking about the Trump and Kim romance is that after 2019, when the Hanoi summit failed, they didn't result in any concrete deals at all. And when Donald Trump lost the election in 2020, then North Korea just simply ignored him. So at this point, even though Trump was declared the winner for like more than a week now, the North Korean state media have not published any articles about his victory. That is really interesting, because if the North Korean, they are really happy or they are satisfied with the Trump victory, then they might have welcomed his victory like much earlier.
Kang, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Kang Vu is a North Korea analyst and visiting scholar at Boston University. group of Dene men in the Northwest Territories are getting together to sew. They're taking part in a workshop put on by Killiquip First Nation in Fort Simpson to give men a space to learn a new skill and connect to each other and their culture. Each man cut a vest's worth of Melton wool, heavy satin lining, and traditional smoke-tanned moose hide trim, and brought a design to embroider the vests. Wilbert Antoine brought a vest his mother made him 60 years ago as inspiration.
It was really a lot of anticipation, wondering what the final product is going to look like. So today I put on a white shirt and a black pair of pants, like I was going to a drum dance, and I'm going to be wearing my one-of-a-kind vest today, and I'm going to show it off.
You sound so proud.
I am. It's exhilarating. You wouldn't know, you don't know the feeling that we're having. I'm having. I'm sure everyone else is having the same feeling that I am. Our mom was very, very, very good at this. And one of the things that she always did when we went off to residential school in late August was she always made sure that we had real nice moccasins, nice clothes, and mitts and everything else. And it all got taken away, and we wore coveralls and different types of clothes, and we went home with runners. We don't know what happened to our moccasins. That's always on my mind. But every day I look for something positive and try to forget those kind of things. I don't know if you can hear the sewing machines in the background. That's what we're doing. And my three girls says, we can't wait until we see pictures of you doing the sewing machine and the ironing and all that kind of stuff.
That was Wilbert Antoine speaking with CBC Yellowknife producer Kate Kyle. The men are getting expert advice from Dene fashion designer Darcy Moses.
It feels great. It's nice to be working with all age levels of guys from here in the Dacho, and it's sort of setting a precedent. It used to, now we're getting to a point in time where it's not just grandmothers or aunties or mothers making vests for the men in the family, but these guys are learning how to make their own vests. And what's interesting about it is that we're also utilizing computer digital technology. And some of these guys, their designs are pretty cool. It's not just, like on my vest here, it's Dene flowers. No, they're coming up with like their own designs, their own colors, geometrics, really cool. Some very hip, some more traditional. So it's nice.
That was Dene fashion designer Darcy Moses speaking with CBC Yellowknife producer Kate Kyle.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.